Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and, of course, our two fabulous producers, Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. As you've come to expect, we begin every show with the powerful words of Colonel Vindman. We thought that that was probably one of the most challenging and emotional times in our lives when he testified in November of 2019. Little did we know, every single day and every single week since then, it has been something even more challenging. But as he told his father it would be all right, we now know it's not all right. The words of Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearing.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Well, if it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. And if it's Scott Braddock, it must be the voice of Texas. And if it's the voice of Texas, it must be the editor of the Quorum Report. And if it must be the editor of the Quorum Report, it is the dean of the Austin Press Corps. These are very challenging times. Mm-hmm. Every state is sort of coming to this COVID-19 issue in different ways.
Yeah.
Some governors are leading. Some mayors are leading. And the president is dying to get us back to work. The operative word is who's going to die to get back to work. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about your state of Texas and about the leadership or lack of leadership from Governor Abbott. What's happened since last week?
The governor confused a lot of people. And we talked about some of this last week, Arnie, the idea that there are states all over the nation that have ordered people to do what? To shelter in place or stay at home. Nuance to that, the leadership will tell you there's a difference between sheltering in place versus staying at home. I'm not sure that there is, but in most of these places, there is, you know, some exception. You can, you know, go leave the house every couple of days to go get groceries and that sort of stuff. Essential services are open, and that's true in Texas. But when the governor, and this was a headline in the New York Times this past weekend, it said something like, can you lead a state response to COVID-19 without taking sides? And Greg Abbott is giving it a shot because he's just so tepid in his delivery, Arnie, and he confuses people because he's a judge. This is a guy who spent most of his life in the third branch of government, in the judiciary. He was was on the Texas Supreme Court. He was an attorney. He was the attorney general. And as a veteran lobbyist said the other day, and this is part of why some of the communication is broken down between the governor's office and local leadership here, which has, you know, acted very, in some cases, aggressively and in important ways, especially in Dallas County and Harris County, where Houston is. There's been a fight between the Dallas County leadership and the governor. And this veteran lobbyist said, you know, why doesn't Abbott just pick up the phone and talk to the county judge in Dallas and, you know, figure out a strategy for our urban centers, which are maybe, and I don't want to scare anybody, that would not be appropriate, but, you know, just look at the numbers. Our urban centers, Arnie, like Houston and Dallas, are maybe lining up to be, you know, the next New York or New Jersey's in that, you know, the exponential growth of the disease and the hospitalizations and infections is going to happen in these large areas. Why doesn't the governor just talk to them, you know, and hash out a plan and go with it? And the fact that he spent so much time in the judiciary means that he views most, and this is part of his psyche, he views private communications as ex parte communications. You're not supposed to do that. So he just doesn't talk to people. It's not in his blood. He has said before that he approaches the job of governor the same as when he was on the Supreme Court, when, you know, where people would come and make their case to him, and then he would render some decision. And he has, approached legislative sessions this way to the frustration of a lot of members of the legislature, and I can come back to that. But he confused people by saying, and this was the quote from the press conference last week, he said, this is not a stay-at-home strategy. That's not what we're doing. They're doing that in some other places, like in New York and in California, for example. And people were confused. Every headline in every major daily newspaper in the state was significantly different because people were reading the executive order that he had issued and listening to his words. At best, he buried the lead. At worst, he just confused the hell out of everybody. The very next day, he released a YouTube from his office. They called it a PSA on COVID-19. And after saying this is not a stay-at-home strategy, the next day he said, this executive order requires Texans to stay at home, with some exceptions. And then he listed what some of the exceptions were. And of course, there's a big fight in Texas about whether people ought to be going to church on Easter Sunday. This is something that's happening across the country where people are concerned about folks going to their places of worship, especially in this High Holy Week for Christians, starting with Palm Sunday and leading up to Easter this weekend. You have a lot of people who do want to go to their place of worship and practice their faith. But most pastors we've heard from in Texas are not interested in that because they know that there's a public health risk and they don't want to put their flock at risk, of course. And you had sent the moving story from East Texas where, you know, the Easter lilies are just sitting there to rot because there are not going to be church services. It's very unfortunate. As we talked about last week, and we learned when we were kids in Sunday school that the church is the people, not the building. But the governor in his executive order said that church services are considered essential. So if pastors do want to go on and do it, there's nothing in his order that says that they cannot. So this has confused people. He's not been a model of leadership in the country. Did you see Sheldon Adelson, the casino magnate? I think we talked a little bit about it.
A big supporter of Donald Trump. And the state of Israel. Right.
Huge. And, you know, a big Republican mega donor, the owner of Las Vegas Sands Corporation in Las Vegas, he had written an op-ed in which he said that the governors in Democratic states, and he specifically said Cuomo and Newsom in California, that they had acted decisively, swiftly, had done right by their people. And that's the kind of leadership that we're looking for in a crisis like this. He did not mention the governor of one of the biggest states, Texas, Greg Abbott.
So let me say something, because I'm noticing that the Republican governors in places like Maryland, in places like Massachusetts, in places like Vermont, and sort of my state of New Hampshire, that they are acting in a relatively decisive manner. And yet what I think is so important is this is why you need Democrats and Republicans. When you totally control the legislature, the lieutenant governor, the governor, there is no checks and balances. So as a result, you know, instead of being tempered and rational in your response, it almost forces you to go to the extreme. And what you see with Massachusetts, Vermont, Maryland, and my state of New Hampshire is because there is this sort of democratic check. Mm-hmm. What they do is they kind of check each other, and each gets actually a little bit better at making better decisions, at actually having conversations. And in the end, the state benefits because you actually have that, I think it's good tension, not bad tension. I almost think that every Republican deserves a Democratic legislature, or every Democratic governor deserves to have some branch of government that may in fact be controlled by Republicans, because it keeps the lines of communication open and it makes, I think, for better and measured decision-making.
We often talk about these situations as divided government, but I like to call it balanced government. In 2009 in the Texas House, the Democrats had basically fought their way back from the big budget cuts in 2003. The people of Texas gradually sent more Democrats back to Austin because they didn't like what they were seeing come from Republican state government. And in 2009, before the Tea Party wave of 2010, in the 150-member Texas House, there were 76 Republicans and 74 Democrats.
Wow.
And so they were evenly split, basically. And what you would see is real tension, real pull, that tension you talk about, real push and pull when it came to ideas and policy. And, you know, when you have a legislative body that is evenly divided like that, and it still is a Republican majority, but when you have an even division, if a single member of the legislature walks up to the front microphone and there's a specific question in front of the 150 members and they make an impassioned, reasoned argument based on facts, if they can change 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5, they really only need 3 to change the course of the legislation, to change the decision that's made about government at that moment. Look, we saw an example of this happen this week in Wisconsin, right, where the Democratic governor had said he wanted to hold off and he wanted to respect, I think he wanted to respect the proper roles of government. He didn't want to overreach as the executive and said, look, I'm going to try to get the legislature, controlled by Republicans, to say, let's move the election back. Let's wait. Let's consider everybody's health and safety here, because we have a global pandemic playing out. Republicans did not agree with that. And they, of course, wouldn't do it. I think they gaveled in for a special session for 30 seconds and gaveled out without doing anything, is what the story was. And then he went ahead and did an executive order. They sued him over that. And then they went ahead and had the election. You see this push and pull. But to me, it's always a better debate when they have to, like you say, check each other on these things. And then the public can weigh in, because the voters are the ones who will get the final say on that stuff.
What's interesting for me is that when I was running for governor in 1991 and 92, 91 was the beginning of my sort of fight for the primary. One of the things I reminded everyone in New Hampshire was the problem with Republicans controlling everything was that instead of dealing with problems, they would shove them under the rug. I said, and now it's 1991 and 92, our economy is hemorrhaging and everything is coming out from the other side of the rug. They didn't fix anything. They hid it. But for a time, it worked. But at some point in time, all the rot, all the failure to address problems is eventually going to come back to bite us in the proverbial you know what. Mm-hmm. And I said, so one of the reasons I'm running is not because I am a Democrat. It's because we need to have an opportunity to not shove it under the rug anymore and to begin to address the problems. It isn't that I'm magical, but I'm willing to at least say, don't hide them, confront them. You know, and that's important. And that's, I think, part of the problem with your governor is that he hasn't been forced to lead. He hasn't been forced to confront the problem because in a lot of ways, what's the pressure? The Republicans control everything. Mm-hmm. So therefore, instead of anyone sort of raising their hand and saying, excuse me, Governor Abbott, we need a decision. He's almost validated in this sort of, you know, mugwump, you know, sit on the fence and sort of say one thing, then say another thing, but it's not decisive. And this is a time for decision making.
Yeah, no one's going to challenge him. And, as the protections go in for the permanent Tom DeLay's permanent majority in Texas, years ago, it was Ronnie Earl, the Travis County District Attorney, who you may remember hearing about. He was there for years. He prosecuted both Republicans and Democrats for abuses of power. Ronnie Earl passed away this weekend. He was in his 70s and had been in poor health. And I was reminded that Earl always talked about the idea that you have to have power to abuse it. For years, it was the Democrats who had the power. And he had actually, as a Democratic district attorney in Travis County, he had prosecuted far more Democrats than Republicans. And he would say the Democrats were in power in Texas for 100 years. And so that's who was abusing the power. Right. And when the Republicans took over, he prosecuted a few Republicans, including the former majority leader, Tom DeLay. We see the effects of what happened with the redistricting that was forced through back in 2003 at the behest of DeLay with Tom Craddock, who was the Speaker of the House at the time. And in the meantime, the leadership here has sought to eliminate those checks on their power, Arnie. And this is always what happens when anybody gets in power. They don't want to be held accountable, of course. And, you know, folks will say, well, like, why is the press in Texas? So why is the Quorum Report or Braddock or whoever always questioning the Republicans? I said, because that's who's in power. If Democrats were in power, I'd question them. Exactly. But they're not. So I'm not focused on that. If I was working
in New
York,
a great reminder. But that's a great reminder. You have to have power to abuse it. That's a brilliant, brilliant line. I go back to having this conversation with my dad. We were talking about my running for governor. And he was sort of saying to me, well, you know, you don't know how you will behave until you're given the power.
That's right.
You make the assumption that you will be better. You make the assumption that you will be tempered. You make the assumption. He goes, but you don't know. Until you have the power, you don't know how you'll behave. You hope one thing, but that isn't guaranteed. This was my papa, who knew his daughter, just like you were just describing. That's such an important thing to say, which is why the press is so important. The press isn't partisan, but they will notice the power and they'll notice the abuse. And whether it's Democratic power or Republican power, that's their job.
No question at all. And, you know, it's the people who really make these offices. You know, I have now covered, enough cycles and turnover in state government in Texas to know that, you know, whether it's the comptroller, the governor, the lieutenant governor, the agriculture commissioner, land right. commissioner, whatever, those offices change depending on who's in them. It's like if you give somebody the keys to a muscle car, to a sports car, everybody would drive that differently. The same levers are there, but it's the person that points a direction.
Elizabeth Warren has a wonderful line, and her line is that personnel is policy. Hmm. And I want everyone to remember why she says that, because you can have policy, but it's not just prosecutors that have prosecutorial discretion. Whoever is in charge has discretion. So they can put emphasis on one piece of policy, they can put emphasis on one part of the regulation, they can ignore it, and that's why personnel is policy. And that's exactly what you were saying. So let's go to this, because I think I need to have, like, I don't know, a Bufferin. GOP mega donor, Dallas businessman Brent Ryan, mm-hmm. Brent Ryan, to lead task force created by the Lieutenant Governor Patrick to restart the economy. You guys haven't even experienced COVID-19 the way most of the country has. You haven't even shut things down to a large extent.
Well, no, that's not fair. Things are shut down all over Texas, Arnie. Right. But I would say it's an interesting moment, once again, where the lieutenant governor is the one leading on this and the governor is not. And the lieutenant governor, who obviously I've been critical of from time to time, he has always filled the void. When our governor, Greg Abbott, when Abbott dithers, which is what's happening, Patrick is always the one who rushes in and sort of is happy to drive the narrative and create the next story. As Abbott was dithering and not giving us a clear direction on whether we were even supposed to shelter in place or not to this past week.
Right, there you vacillation.
Go. Right, here's the lieutenant governor who, remember, went on Fox News Channel a few weeks ago, Carlson Show, and he said, well, maybe senior citizens like myself, he's 70 years old this month, mm-hmm. and he was talking about how maybe senior citizens would like to be asked the question, hey, would you sacrifice your life so that we can have a better economy? Very poorly worded attempt at that argument. But here you have him setting up a task force to say, look, once the president and the governor have said it's okay to start to phase back into any sense of normalcy, not that we get a quick green light that says we all go back to normal, because that's not really going to happen. But once we get any kind of sense that it's okay to start with something new, we need to have some recommendations from the people who know how the Texas economy works, and that's our business leaders. And I would say Brent Ryan, who is a Republican mega donor, he is a respected businessman in Dallas, and is certainly no Tea Party guy or anything like mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. I think he would probably come up with some good recommendations. Two problems. One, anything that Dan Patrick does is now seen as sort of clean up on aisle 7 after those stupid comments that he made on Fox News Channel. And then the other thing is, where is Governor Abbott on this? Why doesn't he come forward and say, look, I'm the leader of the state. At some point, we do have to get back to getting people to work in whichever fashion we do that. I like the fact that Governor Cuomo in New York has talked about the idea that it's a false choice to say that we have to pick between keeping people healthy versus putting people back to work. A lot of what we're doing with flattening the curve and everybody staying at home, social distancing, all that sort of stuff, part of what's happening is healthcare professionals and the healthcare experts in our government are trying to gather data and take a look at that, and then they can formulate a public health response that also allows people to go to work and create an economy once again, which is going to be an altered economy, but it doesn't have to be a complete shutdown. It's just a false thing to say we have to have one or the other. I agree with Governor Cuomo about that. And hopefully these business leaders in Texas who are going to be, you know, operating under the auspices of this task force with the lieutenant governor will take that approach, and they won't be stupid about it and say, well, we should just send people back to work, you know, regardless of what the health implications are. I don't think they're going to do that.
Well, let me just say something. I think we've tested less than 1% of the population. Okay. So we know nothing. We know nothing. And I think if he does create the task force, when you talk about bringing back the economy, the way you bring it back the economy is that you guide it through health. Mm-hmm. And that is that you test people, you test people, you test people. You find out whether they actually have already had the illness. You begin to look if they have the antibodies. What you need to do is figure out how to channel people into the economy. But the way you know you can channel them is because they've been tested. I go back to China all the time. In China, everyone who goes on a train has their temperature taken. Everything about their economy, whether it's in Wuhan, Shanghai, or Beijing, is about the health of the individual as they go back to work. And so work is the goal, but how you get to goal is through your health. And that's what I would love people to talk about. So if they really want to talk about getting the economy back, then the thing they should be chanting over and over again is get every freaking person tested. And if we do that, you would be amazed at what we could do, but right now we can't.
Got to get people tested, tested for the virus, and also the antibody testing to see if people have, you know, maybe already self-resolved, and if they do have any sort of immunity built up to the thing. So that some of those are some of the first people who would be able to go back. We were briefed yesterday by some business leaders here in Texas, including one of the guys who leads one of the big testing companies that's based here in Texas, and was talking about the fact that, look, and these are folks who are not politicians, people who are taking a look at the actual numbers and what they're seeing on the ground, Arnie, did not paint a rosy picture at all of what the testing looks like. The testing is ramping up, but it's still lagging. And some of that is due to lack of testing, of course, but they're also just lacking basic things, basic materials like the swabs that they need to be able to do these tests. And so catching up on all that is a huge job for a state like Texas. We do have the kinds of resources where we should be able to do this. You may have seen where Governor Newsom in California had announced on MSNBC that they had put together a consortium of companies and nonprofits to be able to, be able to provide for 200. That was the commitment. 200. He doesn't have those in his hand today. 200 million of these face masks. In the meantime, here in Texas, we're talking about the order of several million face masks. In Texas, and I was told this by a healthcare lobbyist yesterday, in Texas last year, with none of this going on, with just, you know, day-to-day normal operations of our healthcare facilities. By the way, the Texas Medical Center in Houston is the largest medical district on Earth.
On Earth.
And for our normal hospital operations in Texas last year, we used more than 1 billion with a B, 1 billion face masks. And so to be able to ramp up and really take care of what we need in this state, we're not doing anything close to what they're doing in California.
Well, and I think that's where context is important, because every time I hear Donald Trump talk about, oh, millions of gloves and millions of face masks, if you don't understand how many billion with a B you need per state, let alone across the United States, to deal with this issue, which has spiked the number of face masks that you're going to need and the PPEs you're going to need. And again, I think that's the problem, is nobody puts out the global number. So he gives a big number and you think, wow, isn't that remarkable? But in perspective, it is not remarkable. And I think that's what's so frustrating.
I think it frustrates a lot of people. And look, I think, what does California have? 40 million people, something like that. I mean, we have 28 million people in Texas across 254 counties and two time zones. We talk all the time about how big Texas is, but we have a lot of these rural communities where there may be either no reported cases of COVID-19 or maybe one reported case of COVID-19. We had seen out in the panhandle of Texas, which is roughly the size of Indiana, and it's very sparsely populated. We had seen in an area called area around Castro County out there, where there were several cases of COVID-19, but that's because they were fortunate enough to get some tests. I don't know how many tests are actually being taken to places in West Texas or far West Texas down to the Valley, et cetera. We're starting to see the cases ramp up in Houston, which of course is an international city. And that's why it's probably on track to follow the follow what has happened in New York and some of these other places, not just in the United States, but around the world. A huge concern. The next wave may be coming, and it may be going to hit Texas.
Scott Braddock, stay healthy, please. Stay healthy, please. We need to hear your voice every week, and Texas absolutely needs you, because whether it's a Democrat in power or a Republican power, your job is to challenge the power when it's abused.
We're here
to do
it.
Thank you so much for that. All right, thank you so much. Current Cast is next. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude. We'll be right back.
Try not to get carried away on this Current Cast. When you think rip current, you might think the Atlantic Ocean, but rip currents are quite common in the Great Lakes as well. National Weather Service meteorologist John Hitchcock says there are a couple conditions necessary to create a rip current.
One, you need a fairly windy day that generates significant wave action. Then the second part you need is a sandy shoreline.
When the wind piles waves up on the beach, the pressure carves a trench in the sand that allows water to rush back into the lake. This happens so quickly that it carries everything out with it, including the unlucky swimmer. But don't panic. Hitchcock says you can escape from a rip current by swimming parallel to the beach. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future, supported by New York's Environmental Protection Fund and Sea Grant, online at currentcast.org.
Mona Lisa, Mona Lisa, men have named you. You're so like the lady with the mystic smile. Is it only 'cause you're lonely they have blamed you? For that Mona Lisa strangeness in your smile. Do you smile to tempt a lover, Mona Lisa? Or is this your way to hide a broken heart? Many dreams have been laid at your doorstep. They just lie there and they die there. Are you warm? Are you real, Mona Lisa? Or just a cold and lonely, lovely work of art?
Us riding nowhere, spending someone's hard-earned pay.
Sit down, take a look at yourself. Don't you want to be somebody? Someday somebody's gonna see inside. You have to face up. You can't run and
bless my soul, but what's wrong with me? I'm itching like a man on a fuzzy tree. My friends say I'm acting wild as a bug. I'm in love, I'm all shook up.
I'm sorry, so sorry that I was such a fool.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Every other Friday, we get to rejoin one of our old faves, Dr. Politics, otherwise a professor at Iowa State. Stefan Schmidt joins us. Stefan, I wrote this down because I was at, I think it was the Washington Post and the New York Times, and they said, here's what you need to know. The list keeps getting longer and longer and longer, but I thought this was fascinating. 16 million have filed for jobless benefits in the last 3 weeks. The Senate is set to consider billions in relief for small businesses, but delays are expected. It only takes one senator because they have to do it by unanimous consent. About 90% of hospitalized patients had at least one underlying condition, says the CDC. The virus came to New York mainly from Europe, not from Asia. Oh, I'm shocked. Unemployed workers are helping each other navigate their new realities. And I just thought this was kind of interesting. The virus has killed more people in the Navajo Nation than in the entire state of New Mexico. This is not a disease that treats everyone the same. And I think that's part of the problem. Everyone keeps saying it's an equalizer. You know, whether it's Boris Johnson or someone on the Navajo Nation, it doesn't discriminate. But you and I both know, Stefan, that's just not the case.
Well, it's not the case. And I'm wearing my bandana because we're supposed to have face masks, but in Iowa, we don't have any face masks. Yeah. But we have a lot of bandanas because I'm on my farm. And, you know, we don't have the statistics. This is going to require some really interesting, deep data mining and analysis to know, you know, who suffered the most, where it came from, what. I mean, we know some things now, but we don't know enough about it. And so, of course, surprise, surprise, low-income people, people who are obese or are not in good health in other ways, are much more vulnerable, and minorities tend to fall into those categories. So we see more Black and Latino victims of it. Plus, the service industry is more minority populated than you know, banks and Wall Street and brokerage firms or even academic institutions. And so those folks have to be out there. The New York subway system apparently may shut down because so many people who work in the New York subway system are sick. And so, you know, we're faced with a medical crisis, but also a kind of political and moral crisis. And we're going to have to try to wrestle with that.
Sorry about that. My connection is unstable.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're unstable, too. So it's okay.
Yeah, it is. Not only is it about the, I saw the article from the CDC, and what they were talking about was the underlying conditions. And the two underlying conditions they were talking about, Stefan, was obesity and hypertension. Okay, those were like overwhelmingly the two. And as I'm reading this article, you know what comes into my head? The big gulp and processed food. I was screaming as I'm reading this, because when you realize what big, not just Big Ag, but General Mills and Pillsbury and all the people that are in the business of processed food, sugar is kind of an addiction. Yeah. And when you see how much more sugar is in what you would think should never even require sugar, it has sometimes 5 to 8 times more sugar in the processed version than if you had made it at home. And you begin to see the consequences of that. And especially in places like New Orleans, where you can just see the level of obesity by state, especially in the South, it's through the roof. And so once again, it's not surprising. You've got poverty, you've got obesity, and you've got a challenge to access to healthcare. That's a trifecta of failure. Before we sort of move off a topic, Wisconsin, there was a wonderful article that was written. The article began, "In November, Remember Wisconsin." And I think the story of Wisconsin is both a story that is so chilling that you would have to consider even your health and safety in your life when you want to exercise the franchise, as if you would ever think that this would be an issue. I mean, it might be an issue in the Middle East. It might be an issue in some African countries, but that it would be an issue here. And yet that decision about life and death was being driven by partisan politics. Explain that to me.
Well, that's, you know, we've seen voter suppression for years, right? I mean, you move districts. First of all, you do redistricting so that you disadvantage one party. So if the Republicans are in charge of the legislature and redistricting comes up, which it will after this census, you try to draw the district lines so that your opponent's supporters are all split up, and so you win more seats, you have a better chance of winning. You move voting stations around, so polling places, you put them in, take them away from places where your opponent is likely to get more votes. In this particular case, you say, no, we're not going to do it. And President Trump was right up front about it. I mean, he said, you know, if we do voting by mail, you know, the Republicans are going to lose a lot of elections. You know, that's certainly, Hugo Chavez said the same thing.
And when you also look at what happened in Wisconsin, it wasn't just about a decision to hold an election. It was that a lot of the election workers refused to show up. So in Milwaukee County, that normally has 180 polling places, only had five. I mean, talk about sardines. I mean, it was like, I mean, that in a way was even just enhanced the fear. And yet I want to know, and I keep saying this, I want the United States Supreme Court and I want the Wisconsin Supreme Court to sign any death certificates of any people where you can go back to the fact that they were in somehow in a voting situation and they died from COVID-19. I want them to own that. They own the decision to make them vote, to have them vote, then they need to own the consequences of that, and that could include death.
Well, absolutely. And you know, it is so tragic because the United States for so many years was a country, Jimmy Carter in particular, who went to other countries to try to make sure that their voting was done properly, that the votes, polling places were available, people were allowed to register, then the votes were counted, you know, without corruption. And now, you know, we're becoming a joke in terms of voter security. The Congress, Senate refuses to pass legislation to really improve voting machines, which are not very secure as it is. And then this whole thing, you know, with this virus, I mean, we've got to have a convention for the Democrats and Republicans, and they probably are going to have to do it by distance like we're doing. And then the question is, in November for the election, will things be back to normal so that all the polling places will be open? And I think the answer is probably not. But yet we're not doing anything about it.
So it's really interesting. So Mnuchin was saying that he thought that we could start bringing the economy back in May of 2020. And I am looking at an article that Scott Braddock, who is on with us the first half hour, he had sent it to me. We didn't get into the topic, but the business community in Texas, a number of businessmen are saying, yeah, we'll get back in May of 2021.
Wow.
Okay. So they have more of a come to Jesus moment where they're being really honest. They are planning not for a May, not for a summer, recognizing that fall, it might come roaring right back. They have to be aware and honest with themselves. And for them to say 2021 is incredibly sobering, but as much as Donald Trump and Mnuchin want to start something, these are businessmen that realize the consequences of starting it prematurely. And it will not only be that the economy will not come back, but it will exacerbate and extend the failure.
Yeah. But my question then is, hey, are you folks calling Donald Trump up? Are you going to the White House courage and saying to him, listen, I'm not intimidated by you. I am the CEO of a $1 trillion company. You're the president of the United States. And I'm going to tell you what I think. And, you know, these people are all scared to death of Trump and they sort of worship him. And he's managed to, you know, really, you know, turn them into kind of zombies, which is surprising because a lot of them don't agree with him on a lot of things, but they don't seem to have the courage to confront him. And I will just say, you know, that's not great leadership, business men and women.
You know, but let me just say something. Donald Trump's a coward. Donald Trump is a coward. He is afraid to make a decision. He's always blaming someone or having someone else pull the trigger. Yes. He is a coward. If all of a sudden all these businessmen stood up and confronted him, he would be totally intimidated. Why? Because they're more successful than him. Because they get bigger paychecks than him. Because they control more of the economy than him. They could so easily intimidate him because he's such a coward. But for whatever reason, his bravado has somehow convinced them that they should not challenge him. I am telling you right now, he's like a balloon. All you got to do is prick it and it will blow up.
The other thing is I was told many of them have hands that are much bigger than his.
Yes, you're probably right. Probably right. All right. So the big story this week was Bernie. And I think Wisconsin kind of helped. And I think Bernie suddenly realized, look, I don't want to have death on my hands. I don't want people to come somehow think that they need to somehow show up for me. Because, I mean, if they can do it safely, that's fine. If they can do it, you know, by absentee ballot, that's fine. But God help it. I don't want to be like the Supreme Court in Wisconsin, and I don't want to be responsible. Because in the end, I do care about their health and safety. I'm on the ballot, you know, and if you can do this safely, go for it. But I'm not going to encourage this to continue. So let's talk a little bit about Bernie, because I saw something at the Plum Line at the Washington Post, I think it was. And what it said was the negotiations have already started. And the first thing we heard out of Biden was Biden sort of began to sort of pass the olive torch or the olive branch torch, whatever it's both, I guess, to Bernie and said, okay, how about this? How about instead of Medicare for all, we reduce Medicare to 60? And instead of giving everyone free college, how about if I sort of get rid of debt for, you know, everyone who goes to public colleges or you know, historically black colleges for low and middle income people? How does that feel better? You know, I feel like this is like a dance. You know, we're choreographing between the two of them. And this is like he's putting his toe out and recognizing that Bernie has started the conversation and he wants to begin to build the bridge.
I think you're absolutely right. And I hope that Bernie will be generous, will accept, you know, the fact that he's been admired and spoken well of by a lot of his previous opponents. I saw Mayor Pete this morning on the View or somewhere, and he praised Bernie for getting so many people excited and into politics. And he said he's got some great ideas and we should be grateful to him for essentially sort of stirring up a lot of excitement about all of this. And I hope Bernie realizes that that is a great deal of praise for somebody who is a socialist, democratic socialist, from his opponents who previously really were worried about him. and that he will help the Democrats in getting a good turnout in November. I mean, you know, that we need two good, strong political parties. The Democrats need to get their act together. They did well in 2018. They took over the House, you know, which was amazing. And so we need, you know, robust political participation and good access to the ballots. And Bernie can help do that.
But we haven't had two robust parties. Ever since Bill Clinton got elected with a new Democratic agenda, it has been Republican light. Let's be honest. It has worshipped Wall Street. It has wanted to somehow, you know, we're going to be tough on crime as if warehousing more people was the answer. Now we see that all these prisons are hotbeds of death. Because of what's happening, look at Rikers, look at Sing Sing, look what's going on in Cooks County. We're finding out that the Democrats, who so, in a way, they were jealous of Republicans. You've heard me tell this story before. I'm running for Congress in 1996, Stefan. I'm one of, I think, six Democrats in that class that were brought down to Washington to be showcased to the Democratic congressional group. And so there's all the Democrats in Congress, and everyone's talking about what they want to do. And finally, I raised my hand and they said, okay, Arnie, I was one of the six. What do you see? What do you think we need to hear? And I said, I think that I'm jealous of Republicans, and I think you are too. And they looked at me and they goes, jealous of Republicans? I said, yeah, you're jealous because Republicans' entire agenda can fit on a bumper sticker. And the word is no. No taxes, no regulation, no government, no healthcare. That is their answer. I said, and you know what's so beautiful about it, and you love it, is that as soon as you say the word no, it ends the conversation. You don't have to explain no. I said, and you know what I think our problem is, only I think you've forgotten it, is that we're not about no. We're about yes. Yes, some government. Yes, some taxes. Yes, some healthcare. Yes, some regulation. And you know what's wrong with yes? It doesn't fit on a frickin' bumper sticker. And it takes time. I said, but you know what you've forgotten? Is that you don't build a life around no. You build a life around yes. You need to remind the American people that the reason I say that is that this is what you do. Yes, I love you. Yes, I'll marry you. Yes, I'll have children. Yes, I'll take this job. Yes, I'll buy this house. And guess what? You don't say yes to everything. You don't say yes to every house, every job, every child. You actually make a qualified and you weigh it before you get to your yes, but you don't build a life around no. You've forgotten to celebrate why leadership, in ultimately, from your perspective, is about yes. You want the Republicans no? I'm sorry, that's not your job. And that's your point about the two robust parties. The Republicans have become more robust in their no's, and we became more muffled in our yes.
Well, I mean, Democrats certainly in 2018 said maybe. They said yes in some places. They said no in a few places. As a result, got a majority in the House. So the United States is not a country, Arnie, and people forget that. The United States is Europe. It is the union of the United States of America. And parts of the United States are like Italy, and other parts are like Germany, and other parts are like Poland. And you cannot have the same big policy on a bumper sticker for every part of the country, because in some places, pretty moderate Democrats got elected. In other places, very extremely liberal progressives like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez got elected. And if the national party is in a bad place, if they try to develop essentially a uniform sort of policy for the entire country, because some things sell better in some places and not so well in others.
Don't you think the pandemic has changed that? Because all of a sudden, the healthcare, I am hearing Republican governors and I'm hearing Republican legislators say, maybe we should have expanded Medicaid.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, really? My middle fingers are up in stereo. What this has exposed is the level of income insecurity. What this has exposed is the idea of access to healthcare. What this has exposed is our lack of investment in public health. What this is, this has really ripped off the scab. And what is oozing up is that rich wasn't rich for a country. It was rich for the top 5 or 10%. Yeah. And when the 5 or 10% are incredibly wealthy, the nation is not. The nation is not. I lived in Orford, New Hampshire. Orford, New Hampshire had about 1,100 people. And I said, here's the problem. If a billionaire moves into Orford, on paper, we look incredibly rich. Because if you average his billion with the 1,100 of us, we're all millionaires. I said, but guess what? Not one of us saw our incomes change. Not one of us saw our schools get better. Not one of us saw our infrastructure improve. We do have a billionaire next door, but guess what? We couldn't benefit from the billions because that's not how we operate. Well, that's what's happened in America. We have a lot of really rich people and wildly successful, but the economy and the public at large, we didn't invest in them.
You should run for president, Arnie, because you summarized exactly what the issue is. And you may be right that this crisis has now ripped, essentially, the Wizard of Oz is not the wizard anymore because he's just some little guy moving things behind a curtain.
Exactly.
And I was watching the lines of automobiles at the food banks in places around the country. And it's shocking. It's third world country. It is heartbreaking. And it is unbelievable that in Des Moines, Iowa, the schools closed for the coronavirus, but they're having to hand out the lunches and the breakfasts because such a giant percentage of kids in Des Moines, Iowa schools don't get breakfast or lunch unless the school gives it to them. Incredible.
Well, did you hear what Bill de Blasio did? This is even more amazing. Bill de Blasio suddenly realized that those checks that they keep talking about are going to get to you, but a lot of people aren't going to get the checks. Not by the time they realize they have to put food on the table and there's no money in their accounts. Yeah. So what Bill de Blasio did was he started with what they did in Des Moines. He started saying, okay, the kids can get fed, okay? They can get lunch. Then a place said, well, how about lunch and breakfast? Then they said, how about lunch, breakfast, and dinner? So here's what he just did. Every place in New York City, you can walk in, whether you're an adult or a child, and get a meal. And they don't ask for any information. They don't ask your name. They don't ask your income. They ask for nothing, Stefan. All you have to do is say, I'm hungry. Can I have a meal? That's what's happened in New York City, because I am hearing that some people won't get checks till August.
I know, it's
till
horrible.
August.
Yeah. And the banks, I just was looking into all this. The banks are going crazy because the federal government hasn't given them good guidance on how to give these loans, forgivable loans, to businesses that are being destroyed by this. So the banks are going, well, we can't give you any money right now, because we don't know about the liability. We don't know what, you know, our shareholders are going to say. We don't know what the rules are. So we have a country that was caught off guard, caught by surprise. We were not ready, for example, for an attack by a foreign enemy. And this is a foreign enemy.
It's a virus.
It isn't rockets, and it isn't people blowing up buildings. But we are so unorganized and so inefficient and so centered on all kinds of issues that are socially divisive issues, that we neglected the idea of management and of preparing for things.
Okay, so I heard of an economist today, just brilliant. And here's what she said, and I think it's based on either the Danish or the Dutch model. And what they did was, instead of letting people get unemployed, they said to every business, we will cover the cost of your employees. I don't know whether it was 100% or 80%, but you keep them on the payroll. Yeah. And the reason why that is brilliant is, one, it keeps you connected to work even if you're not working, number one, which means you can go right back to work. Two, it means the checks get to you because employers know where their employees are. Yeah. So right now what's happened is, and what they did was brilliant, because the one place that you know has a relationship between you and a check is your employer. Yeah. So by giving it to the employers and saying, keep them on the payroll, they stabilized their economy and people weren't afraid, thinking they'd have to wait months before they would even know that a check was in the mail. It's brilliant. And we did not. Why didn't we think? I mean, it's just so stupid, because this is not only inefficient, it is more harmful.
I think we just don't have technocrats and professional people in a lot of the positions in Washington. They are political appointees, and a lot of them are picked for their ideology, and that is not a way to solve problems. I mean, if you want to put a man on the moon or a woman on the moon, you don't pick people because they're liberal or conservative. You pick them because they're good at mathematics and can put a rocket on the moon. Right. And I think we've given up on that. We're hiring people who are ideologically simpatico with the administration in power. I think that the founders had very simple things that they were concerned about. So they said, well, a president should be able to appoint people to run all these agencies at the top, because the president was elected, and so his or her ideology should filter down to these agencies. But that wasn't a simple age, Arnie. It wasn't in an age of complexity. I think it's a bad system. The system is broken. I'm not sure we can repair it. Luckily, I'm old enough that it probably will sort of putter along, but I don't think the system is working, and unless it's changed very drastically, I think we're screwed.
But you see,
and that's my optimistic perspective.
But listen to what you just said. And what you just said is Bernie's revolution. Not that Bernie and everything he offered was right, but the idea is the system is screwed. The system has rotted. The system doesn't make the right investments. The system doesn't bring in the right people based on merit and talent. You talk about Bernie's big problem was he used old language. He's not a freaking socialist. No socialist in the world would recognize what Bernie was talking about. I'm just telling you right now. So in a way, Bernie's strength was also his weakness. Someone had a wonderful article, I think it was at Slate.com, that Bernie's failure was his damn consistency. He was in a freaking rut. And the rut was a language rut. So what happened was that I have evolved in my language. I've evolved in my sense of taste. I've evolved. That doesn't mean I've changed. It means that I've brought in new information and understood how I need to use the language of 2020, not the language of 1975. Yeah. And that was his problem. And I think what we're going to see is that if the Democrats were smart, it wouldn't just be a dance that we're seeing. But what you pointed out is absolutely right. The system as it exists cannot repair what's wrong.
No.
That doesn't mean that everything gets thrown out with the bathwater, but you better start addressing what's wrong. Stefan Schmidt, I love you. And I am so glad that I get to see you on Zoom, which is so incredible, everyone. So thank you so much for joining us.
Be on your show, and thank you for doing it. It's wonderful.
It's fabulous. Anyway, everyone, this is the Friday edition of The Attitude. That was Stefan Schmidt, affectionately known as Dr. Politics from Iowa State. We will see you on Monday.
You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think, let your mind go, let yourself be free. Let's go back, let's go way on the way back when. I didn't even know you couldn't have been too much more than tame.